I ran into the boy, the lead bully. I ran into his mom outside. She accosted me, and she was like, "I just don't believe my son is racist." I da da da, like, start screaming at me. I calmly sat on the front, the hood of my car. I listened to her go off on this whole tirade, right? Because white privilege, right? And so once she was done, I said to her, "I completely agree with you, because even if you are racist and your whole family is racist, there's nothing the school can do about it." And me just saying that shocked her. And she turned around and said, "Well, I suppose my parents still use the N-word, and so maybe that's where he's getting it from."
Welcome to the Immigrant Experience in America, an immigrant human library, where we amplify and humanize the experiences of immigrants in the United States and around the world. Listen in as we add another story to our immigrant human library.
I didn't attack her, and I literally asked her a bunch of questions to lead her down to the answer. And that was really, I don't know if I changed her mind, I probably didn't, but I was happy with the responses, and at least I got a chance to plant a seed. Like, hey, you ignorant, think about this a different way.
Kudos to you for addressing it, because over the years, what I have found, I would be so shocked, and then afterwards, you would beat yourself up that you didn't respond, right? And you would just, it would just eat at you, and I just decided I'm not going to do it. I had a recent example. We're at a playground with this lady. You know, I've noticed in the few times we've hung out over the year that my daughter was in school with her, she would make these comments as if she was trying to make fun of my daughter, some, you know, make these comments, and I would just observe her. So this time around, she said, "Oh, she's growing up. She used to have like a face, like a little face like a mouse." And I'm just like, and her daughter, actually, her features are much smaller than my daughter, right? And I'm sitting there, I'm so shocked with the comment. I'm like, this girl is calling my daughter has a mouse, had a mouse face when she first started the school. And I kind of addressed it with my husband, and he's like, "Oh, you know, that is, it's not a big deal. Don't even bother." And it just kept eating at me. And I'm like, I'm not going to let this slide. I'm going to address it. Yeah. So I sent her a text message, and I said, "You know, you said something on Saturday that just had me thinking, and I don't know what to make of it. Like, can you explain what, how, no, I said, I texted, I said, how would you feel if I call your daughter, if I compared your daughter's face to a mouse, and or say that your daughter looks like a mouse. Can you explain yourself? Like, what does that mean with your comment on Saturday?" So she starts, you know, finding excuses and basically saying, "Oh, it's a saying that her parents use. They're from the island, and you know, these older people have sayings, and you know." And
but she's a younger person. Yes, the older people have that saying, but you're a younger person. You should know better.
Right. And so then she goes, "Oh, my mom makes this saying to my daughter where she tucks her in and said, you're snug like a bug," or I guess they have some sort of saying out there, snug like a bug, snut, nut. And I said, "Well, that connotes a completely different emotion and feeling." Right. And I sent her, I followed up by sending her a snippet of Cardi B and Nicki Minaj fighting because one of them said something, Nicki said something about Cardi B's child. And I was sending her a message to her, "You don't talk about my child," right? I said, "You're lucky I'm not some woman," yeah, "because they will fight you down for making a comment like that." And she would, I did apologize. And I said, "Yes, I know you apologize, but I'm sending this to you so you know this is what people will do if you talk about their children." And I wanted to address it so she knows, don't go there with me in the future. So we have to, if you allow people to continue to take these jabs at you, they will continue to treat you like a victim. And over time, that just keeps reinforcing. You will never get over that emotion. It'll just keep eating at you. So sometimes you have to decide to address these things. I know you have to choose your battle. My husband will say, you can't bat after every ball that people throw at you, right? But in certain circumstances, you have to address these things. And it would baffle me so many times.
Your husband is right. To an extent that you can't bat after every ball. I love that saying. I'm going to have to use it from now on. But I think that you're also right in that if it eats at you, if it gets to your core, If you feel disrespected, if you think it crosses a boundary, it did. And what we need to learn, you know, a mutual friend of ours that we both know, she is the queen of asking, and what exactly do you mean by that? She's native born American, and her phrase when she feels out of pocket or she feels that someone is being out of pocket and it unnerves her and it makes her feel a certain way, the one question as sweet as pie with a smile on her face that she will ask you, and what exactly do you mean by that? And just that question puts the other person on the back foot because you're not being nasty. Anybody else who's in earshot or in the vicinity, you asked her a simple question for clarification. And so that's the one phrase that I'm now asking when I feel like somebody's coming at me in a way that strips me, that's meant to make me feel belittled or, you know, small. I ask, and what exactly do you mean by that? Obviously, I shared with you my own experience that had happened the day before, when we were talking about doing this podcast. And it was a situation where I was in a group of women. Everybody was allowed to introduce themselves, and this person didn't allow me to introduce myself. I didn't say a word, but I sat there and I thought, what is my response going to be if she says, you know, like, oh, you can now introduce yourself or whatever. And so about half an hour goes by, and then she says, you know, oh, Nina, we forgot to introduce you. And I'm thinking to myself, no, you didn't. It's okay. You skipped me on purpose, and that's okay. And my response straight away was, it's okay. I thought I was so infamous, I needed no introduction, right? And it's not me being, I'm not being catty. I'm not being confrontational. But it's my way of sort of addressing it like, okay, you know, you're trying to put me in my place, but there's no place for me to be at because I'm an independent, strong woman. And it didn't faze me. If I hadn't been introduced, that's the part that I think I've had to learn to control. I can't control other people's actions, right? And I think when you're from a community culture, there's more of a onus that you are your brother's keeper, right? Like that culture kind of exists. So in a sense, when you're not controlling people, they are accountable to you for their actions, right? I told you about my time in Sierra Leone. There was a time that I did something in the street on my way home. And so one of my dad's family friends saw me. And literally, it was a game of telephones. By the time I got home, my dad had already knew what I did. And there was a whooping waiting for me, right? So, you know, the whooping part wasn't fun. But that's what happens when you're part of a community. You are your brother's keeper, and you're accountable to someone else. When you go to an individualistic culture, people do things that's just, the self is the paramount. The self is about everything. It's all about me, 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 me. And so when people act from that, that's why you have insecurities and different things like that. But if you were more community oriented, you would have a sense of, I have accountability through this person. I can't act an ass or be mean or be nasty for the sake of it, no matter how I'm feeling, because I'm accountable to other people in this community. And my reputation as a community person is important to me. That exists to a lesser degree here. I won't say it doesn't exist. It just exists to a much lesser degree, especially in big cities like Atlanta.
Right. And just this whole normalizing that it is okay to be rude towards people with melanin or more melanin, it's just shocking. It's just shocking to people who weren't raised in environments like that and trying to figure out how to handle it, how to respond and keep your composure. Because sometimes, I mean, it will knock you off of your feet, some of these people's behaviors. It's so shocking. It's just, it's an interesting place to live. I'm still searching for home, honestly. And I grew up in a community too in Jamaica where the neighbors, it was a very small community. I counted the other day the different homes and the number of people, and I couldn't get to 250. So it was less than 250 people. Everybody knew each other. All the adults know all the children. We could walk and, you know, go wherever, and all of us felt safe. But it's just, this is a different type of a place that you're living in this individualistic culture. People tend to just not have that capacity to think of their action and its impact on the other person, on another person, because it's all about self. So if you've never looked up the different differences between a collectivist culture versus an individualistic culture, go and Google, right? It's all about the self in this culture, and self-gratification, and people just, it goes into the whole behavior pattern that you see here. They don't have a sense of, and sometimes they honestly cannot think about anybody else. It's all about me, and what's in it for me. And they're like numb to how their actions impact the other person or their community. And it's really sad. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how to balance, you know, the fact that she has the world to be able to achieve everything she wants to kind of grow herself, but also to be aware of how your actions impact other people, right? And to be able to see that. It's a very challenging task raising a child in this culture, because you want them to be, you know, balanced human beings in this environment that is so different from the one you were raised. And so it's an interesting challenge being an immigrant mom raising a first-generation American child.
That was one of my biggest, and I know we spoke about this before as well, one of my biggest challenges was being a mom. My daughter's my first child. She's 11 now. And when I first started, you know, I remember she was in first grade, when she started there, she was having issues with processing. My son is autistic, so I think processing is something that we kind of my kids are challenged with, for whatever reason, that causes that. And so I went to the school and said, hey, you know, my daughter is really smart, but, you know, she's having difficulty in this area. Can you come alongside me and help me? And they were flat out, no. And it was so shocking to me, because it was like, she has to fail first, and then we'll come alongside you and help you and try to rescue her at that point. I'm like, how backwards is that, that you have to wait, you know, to wait first? And then they were like, 50th percentile is the passing grade here, and your daughter is above 50th percentile. She was like 54th percentile in the areas that I was concerned about, which all involved processing. In every other area, she was in the 90th percentile. And I said, can't you see how this processing thing here in the 50th percentile is going to eventually impact these things here in the 90th percentile? And I literally had to fight tooth, claw, and nail to get them to, I refused to get out of their face. And I looked up different laws and things like that that gave me parental rights to basically force their hands to intervene, which is what I did. And I remember the first meeting I went to, they all said to me, you have a high standard in your house, don't you? And it made me feel so bad, because I was like, oh, I have a high standard, you know. But then, you know, as time has gone on, it's like, yes, I do have a high standard. Black excellence is my standard. And you know what? It shouldn't even be called black excellence. It should just be called excellence. You know what I mean? Like, excellence is my standard in my household. So absolutely, I have a high standard in my household. And it took a while, but that intervention is now why she's in advanced classes. She had the aptitude for it. It's just that she needed a little bit of help and a little bit of support. And she was in that support model for about a year. And they refused me initially and called me one of those, you know, it's I've been part of a lot of PTA groups and been part of a lot of been a room parent several times. And it's weird, because on the one hand, the black parents who don't show up, whose kids aren't reading, who aren't involved, who just overlook and kind of send their kids to just, you know, be taught by teachers, they talk about them. Then you have parents like me who actually are involved, who are like challenging your normative thought of what a black parent looks like. And then you give me hell when I'm asking you for help. And that's where that systematic thing kind of comes up. My daughter initially didn't realize the racial disparity in the school that she was at. But in her final grade, when she got to fifth grade in elementary school, the school she's at, the secondary school she's at now, it's not called secondary, the middle school she's at now is better. But the elementary primary school she was in, I remember in the fifth grade, her teacher broke her leg, like how I've broken my leg, but less worse. And she... She made me go out and buy this teacher like a huge basket, chocolates, all the teacher's favorite things, candy, drinks, all this stuff. We spent money on it, put together this basket, and she went and gave it to her teacher. The same day, another student, a Caucasian student, gave that same teacher a basket of her favorite things or different things. They had different things in each basket. She hugged the Caucasian kid. She did not hug my daughter. And they gave it to her the same time, because I questioned her. I was like, did you give it to her in the morning, the same time as the other person? Yes, we both gave it to her when we came into class. You know, was there space between them? No, we came in one after the other. Like, you know, I asked her all these questions just to try to understand what was happening. But it's one of those things where I can't go up to teach and say, you didn't hug my child. So I didn't even bother addressing it, you know? There were other things that happened that was a little worse that I did address, but that one I didn't address. And it's like, and this teacher did some really horrible things to her. Like one day I forgot to put some money on her bank, on her account, her meal account. I've never not paid the meal account. It wasn't that we didn't have the money. I just forgot. And that teacher let my daughter go all day without eating, even though I had paid for snacks and drinks in that class. She told my daughter she didn't have any and let her starve from 7 a.m. because she didn't eat breakfast either. She was supposed to eat breakfast at school and eat lunch at school. And all the way till 4 p.m. when I picked her up, she was literally shaking. And in those kind of situations, I had to say to myself, you know what, I can't go to war. I got to just let her, you know, I don't want to disrupt her. She didn't want to leave that school. I would have had her out of that school a long time ago, but she wanted to stay. And that's where it's like, my mom did the right thing in pulling me. But I didn't, you know, stability is big for me because I didn't really grow up stable, you know, even though stable in the sense that I moved too many times, my memories are affected, you know, different things like that. My connections are affected because of how many times I moved. I don't want that for my children. So I want stability for them. And in that instance, I almost wish I had kind of like gone against her wishes and pulled her. But it's been great conversations with her and I. The first time I told her about the disparity that exists here, because she lives in an affluent place. She's privileged. She's a privileged black kid at the end of the day, no matter what. But she lives with a bunch of really privileged white kids, you know, Caucasian kids. And I remember she cried. And it broke my heart. I'm like, I'm breaking this child's heart to tell her some of these things because I don't want her to be blindsided. And, you know, kind of like how when we first moved out here, you and I was blindsided. I really wish I had a handbook that had told me this and this and this and this. You know what I mean? Because it would have made my experience and my acclimation and my understanding and my transition so much easier. But I learned the hard way through grit and experiences and having my shock moments. Like, I can't believe you said that to me. And like going home and crying and thinking about like, what did I do? What am I doing wrong? And then, you know, having to figure out that it's not me. This is what they call systematic. And that's the part. I've seen it in my daughter. When from her class, she's being communicated by simply not giving her a hug, that she is less than those that are of Caucasian heritage around her. It starts from when they're young, and it is truly systematic.
Wow. You know, you have to pay close attention to that, because I'm raising a small child too, and I can see she's picking up things as well, and I'm trying to figure out how to have that conversation. You're not ever prepared to address some of these things. I never had to deal with this stuff until laid up in life. But as you mentioned that you needed a handbook, I'm actually writing such a handbook. This first time I'm going to put a plug in there for my book. We're supposed to be publishing or releasing it.
I'm excited.
It's at the end of summer. And I talk about some of these things. It's called An Immigrant Experience Decoding America. So I talk about my experience with finance, my experience with racism, learning racism for the first time, being a working mom, the immigrant mom experience, raising a son or a daughter in the U.S. I tell a lot of personal stories. And then I give tidbits about how to decode the political scene, how to, so many things, because I needed that, and I couldn't find that book anywhere. There was nobody really saying it to me. My family was decoding it for the first time themselves. They didn't even have the language to even realize it was a conversation that needed to take place. We weren't all coming from an environment where that was an issue, and so I really wanted to put pen to paper to really help other people behind me figure out and be better prepared about how to really handle this stuff. Because just thinking, oh, this is just the way it is, you know, this is the way it's always been, and I must come in and now be told I'm a second-class citizen, or I must be accepting of being treated a certain way. When it's painful, it's grieving to the spirit. It's grieving to you on so many levels. And I must just swallow that?
Absolutely.
Interesting place. I say people, like, you know, please listen to these personal stories of people and think about whether this is the place for you. Like, really, I don't know if my family would have come if they knew some of the stories or dynamics of things that we have had to walk through as the younger generation, right? I think they were just looking at the opportunities for us to come and study and have better access to some other thing and exposure, but we were happy. And I have not been able to find the same sense of belonging that I had when I was on the island. I am still, 2 decades later, not being able to find that sense of belonging here. I'm not pale enough, my nose isn't straight enough, my hair isn't straight enough, I'm not black enough, I speak too proper, I'm too educated. I mean, like, where do I fit? Right, so I talk about my search for belonging here, and can't wait for that to drop to help people really kind of find some understanding and solace in knowing that you can figure it out, and you know, and also too, you can decide that this is not the place for you. You have the option, right?
No. Absolutely. The one thing I will say is, you know, obviously you and I know each other from Mocha Moms. I feel like Mocha Moms has kind of given me that. Mocha Moms for me was an answered prayer, to be honest with you, because I was looking for community. You know, the way that everybody at Mocha Moms kind of reacted when I broke my ankle was what I thought it should be. Like, people, from the first day, Simone, before I was unfortunately hospitalized the second time, people were showing up at my door with food and flowers and calling me and texting me. I had like 5 bouquets here the first day and dinner that was prepared and brought that first day, right? And then, you know, and that's what I'm used to. And then different people have come at different times and helped clean my house, or you know, clean my fridge, you know, until I had my sisters, who then came a little bit later, you know, rearranged their lives to come and stay for a period of time. So that was what I was, that's what I'm used to, and that's what I'm was kind of expecting. And one of the things I was going to go back to say, I was going to say 3 things real quick. I know it's very different coming from like Sierra Leone or Jamaica, where you're the majority. We are the majority in those places, right? And so, and even in England, well, in London anyway, black people are very, very prevalent. So it's more about a class system than it is just because simply based on the color of your skin. You know, I grew up with Indians, whites, everything under the sun in England, and we were all the same. It was more about our education and you know, our families were in similar places, so we just naturally gelled based off of our experiences. It's not like that here. Like, one of my first things when I first moved out here, I told you about Katie. I used to try to be friends, and I still am friends. I do have some Caucasian friends here. I want to be very clear about that. But I used to try to be friends with my neighbors who were predominantly all Caucasian, right? And there would always be this thing that I could never quantify or really articulate as to why there was a barrier there. It was like I was tolerated rather than we were friends, right? Yeah, and so it took me a while to kind of really distinguish that and understand that. And so once I did understand that, I then gravitated to those who were Caucasian, who were open-minded, who really wanted to have a deep connection with me. And I have found 2. You know, who are in my circle, in my close circle. And then, you know, everybody else, I treat them as blank slate as I can, you know, and I recognize the limitations of what relationally they can do. And I leave it at that, because honestly, I'm very observant, so I watch them with other people, and sometimes their relationships is just as surface as the relationship that they might have had with me. And that might not be a color thing, that might just be who they are as individuals, and I've had to accept that. That community environment and that community culture that we're talking about breeds deep connections, and that individualistic environment breeds surface connections. And what I can say to you is there are going to be people out there that you can connect with and that you can have common ground with and build those deep connections with. You just have to keep looking. The second thing I was going to say is that, yes, I completely agree. You can have in the book will be awesome. It's going to be amazing. I wish I had had that. And I was also, I told you, I had considered it sometime. I just hadn't had time to sit down and start doing it. I'm glad that you're doing it. It's absolutely going to be a guidebook for anybody who is an alien out here, and so necessary. But I will say there are good things about being in America. There really are. Like, you know, there are a lot of people that I know who have come from outside who have made multi-million dollar businesses, you know, serving people in different capacities. And, you know, even the fact that you're writing a book, I feel like it's only in America that you'd be driven to kind of out of the pain and your frustration comes your testimony through being able to write this book. And America gives you that ground to be able to do it, right? I feel that there's a lot of things that can be positive. It's just having to look into it. And then also learning how to shut yourself off to those things that grieve you until you can figure out a way to interact with those types of personalities and have your Native American phrases ready and things ready to say back, right? That will alleviate you of that burden that's left on you when they strip you in a way that you just don't think is right. When you have something to say, or even better, if you can get them to rethink what they're saying, then that's when you truly have an impact, because they have to change. You challenge them. Like, just like the person with the mouse comment, you challenged her and now she's going to have to rethink it. I'm going to tell you one of my worst experiences here. Actually, it's really not the worst, but it's one that stuck with me most with my daughter. I told you that it started systematically. When my daughter was 5 and we were looking for schools, my husband said to me, I chose this Christian school out here in Roswell. And my husband said to me, no, don't put her in that school. And I was like, she'll be fine. It's a Christian school. You know what I mean? Because this was still back in my days of racism doesn't exist. It's okay. Like, you know, it's okay. And I put her in that school. And she was the only black child there with a black parent and a black mother, black father. There were 4 other black kids there, two to each family, but they were mixed race. They were, mom or dad was black, and mom or dad was white. One of each, basically. And she got bullied. And this is when she had that processing, when she was still learning to like communicate. And she never came and told me what was happening to her. But the first thing she said to me, which really broke my heart, was, Mom, I want to be white. But this was after like a 6 months of her being told that she was ugly because her skin was brown. That, you know, all this nasty thing that these little 5-year-old kids were saying to her. Yeah, they told her that she was ugly because her skin was brown. Yeah. Yeah. And so she could not articulate it. And on that day when they told her that was the day she came to us and, you know, and said to me, Mommy, I want to be white. And I was like just so devastated by what she said, that she wasn't proud to be black, that I was like not thinking, oh, something's going on. That's why she's saying this to me. I was like, you know, like I put her in an all-white school. You know, like this is kind of how I was thinking. And it was another Caucasian mother whose daughter went home and told her what was being said to my daughter that pulled me to the side about 4 weeks later at a birthday party and said, I want to ask you some stuff and please don't think that I'm trying to be racist or anything like that. You know, this is what my daughter's coming home and saying this is being said to your daughter. And I was like, did this happen like 4 weeks ago? She said, yes. And I said, that makes sense. Like for me, instantly it clicked. So I spent my next day working all day, and at 2 a.m. in the morning, I wrote an email to the school saying, I recognize that kids can be mean. I recognize that the easiest way that kids find differences even is in skin color. But when these things happen, you have to tell me. I need to rebuild her. And then they went into crisis mode, called a home meeting with all the parents. And again, I'm the only black parent in the class. You know, I'm making these, you know, Caucasian people feel uncomfortable. Here we are having to talk about race and some instances of unkindness because they handled it all wrong. But here's the kicker. That morning, I ran into the boy, the lead bully. I ran into his mom outside. She accosted me. And she was like, I just don't believe my son is racist. Like, start screaming at me. I calmly sat on the front, the hood of my car. I listened to her go off on this whole tyrant, right? Because white privilege, right? And so once she was done, I said to her, I completely agree with you. Because even if you are racist and your whole family is racist, there's nothing the school can do about it. And me just saying that shocked her. And she turned around and said, well, I suppose my parents still use the N-word, so maybe that's where he's getting it from. You think? That was our conversation. So it was like, you know, some of this stuff is generational, it's taught. I don't think kids, you know, kids, when they meet each other, they meet a child, they meet the soul, and they pick up the stuff from their parents, unfortunately. And so it's just, it's sad, it's difficult, it's hard being the one coming in and being introduced to it. But I took up the mantle a while after I went through my angry black female phase, which my mantle then became, if I can just be an experience where people experience myself and they experience my family and they rethink their vantage point of black people, that's all I need to do. It's not my responsibility, but I want to do it. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm not going to allow you to you know, to come off and tell me things that you think about the black community. No, I'm a different experience. And they really get confused with me because they can't put me in a bucket. I've got a British accent. I sound, you know what I mean? Like, so I challenge all of their ideals and their thinking anyway, just naturally. And my daughter is such a sweet child that everywhere I go, parents, teachers alike, they all tell me what a wonderful child she is. And she really is. She's a blessing from God. But I had to kind of center myself to not let the anger be the prevailing thing that I teach her these experiences through. Because that kind of anger will also eat at you and eat at that child. You know what I mean? If you pass it on. And so I went about it the wrong way. But over time, and as I've gotten more mature in my faith and in my thinking, I challenged myself to have these kind of conversations. And that's what I wish more of America did. If black and whites could sit down from across each other, and even blacks and black Americans versus black immigrants could sit down and have these kind of discussions, the world would be such a better place. No malice, no malintent, with a heart of open and ears that are listening. You know what I mean? I think it would be so life-changing. You might not get to a point of 100% agreeing with each other, but it would make a change.
Join us next time for part 3 of this episode. We thank our listeners around the world, and we appreciate your continued support as we build our human library. Please remember to give us a 5-star review, subscribe, and share with your friends, family, and circle of influence.